Imagine you are at a beach and you're hanging out and seeing all the waves come and go. And you're taking a relaxed break that you deserve. There are all these shells lying around you and the waves are coming and going. And you get an idea. How about you actually collect these shells and make necklaces to sell? Well, how would you go about doing that? Maybe you would collect a few shells and make a small necklace and try to show to your friend. It may not be obvious, but this is where we begin our journey on understanding building data engineering pipelines at scale. So in this episode, I'll use the example of making necklaces and shells, and we'll learn a lot about data engineering and ETL processes. Without further ado, let's get started. When we started, we were talking about making a necklace from the shells on a beach. So the first thing you might want to do is pick a few shells that look really nice, and you will want to like pick them from the beach, and then you might want to assemble them on a thread and assemble a necklace, right? So that process of actually picking the shells is something similar to extract, which is where you're extracting something valuable, something which is possibly interesting in future. And that is the extract of ETL. That's the first E of the ETL process. Having picked the shells, you might realize that they are dirty, right? They might have some sand on them. They might be dirty with some algae and so on. So you might want to clean them. You might want to transform them. You might want to break them. And then slowly you are going to like transform those extracted shells into something very usable in an actual necklace. And this process is the second part of an ETL or transform stage. So this is, we did the extract, now the transform, and then we do the load. So what's the load? Load could mean that you have made the necklace and then you just ship it to your friend, right? And this could mean the load, right? So I've just gotten us started on a very basic ETL process that you might actually embark on a beach. Before we continue with this example, I actually want to give a little bit of background on the real life data, right? I think the example is really good. We'll continue using that, but it's also important to know why we need to study data engineering pipelines at all, right? So we are living in an internet era, and we are generating all kinds of data sets, like both for interactions, transactions, unstructured data like comments, images, and so on. We also have like transaction information like order details, page views, clicks, and so on. So, you know, there is a lot of data we are generating. And there is a demand by the management usually to kind of gain insights from that. Like a lot of the management is getting really smart nowadays about making data-driven decisions. And it's really important to kind of mine that information and make sense of it, right? So there is this one group of practitioners in the company who want to gain insights from data for data-driven decisions. Then there is another group of practitioners in any tech company, which is like the ML and the data science practitioners, who actually want pristine and clean data sets so that they can go ahead and build models or do some kind of prediction, like maybe what to show you on an Amazon recommendation page, right? So there are these two groups of people who both are driven by their desire to use data in interesting ways. So it is really important to understand how this data set can be built, can be used, and can be leveraged to make really like the value of them come true. So Andrew Young, actually, who is one of the legends in the field of machine learning, he has some really famous courses on Coursera. He says that data is the new oil. And, you know, if you use an oil analogy, you'll agree that, you know, oil is really like helpful for the economy. But you still need to drill the oil, right? So in the same way, data is really, really good, but you still need to drill and clean and mine that data to be useful. So even if you are somebody and you're not actually working with engineering pipelines as such, I think it would be still be very helpful for you to understand how data engineering work happens, so that you can really improve yourself in even as a data scientist or ML person, or even as a manager. So this is an episode where we'll continue to kind of use the shell example and just kind of understand the lay of the land. We'll cover at the high level about different concepts, and hopefully they'll be useful. So the first question you might kind of think about is that, so shells lie on the beach, right? But where does this data actually lie, right? Where do these so-called shells even live, right, in the internet companies? So a lot of companies actually typically use something like S3, Amazon S3, which is object-based storage, which is something like data lake. It's like a data lake in the sense it's unstructured, and you can keep data in any format. So you can keep Excel files, CSV, JSON, images, Parquet files, or any other file that you like, it can just live there, and it's very cheap. It's like really, really cheap storage. And so basically, even if you never end up using, say, the transactions data of a customer, it still is there for you if you need it, right? And that's why a cheap storage is always good. So S3 is an offering by AWS. Google Cloud Storage is an offering by GCP. And other cloud providers have a similar service. So it's something, another advantage of using something like S3 or GCS is that they're fully managed by cloud provider. So if suddenly your transactions increase by 100x, like you become really popular, this S3 storage can auto scale and can kind of manage all that distribution of the data across different compute nodes. So that's kind of another advantage of using S3. It's cheap, it's highly available, it's highly durable, and there are different kinds of tiers. So if you don't want to use certain data, you can even pay lesser. If you want to use a data frequently, then it's another tier, and so on. You can replicate the data so that you don't lose the data. So the advantage I've already listed. The con is that it is hard to access the data here, especially if it's like people who love seeing visualizations or business users. They will have a hard time kind of accessing and managing this unstructuredness of a data lake. So we need to find a way to unify these different and disparate sources into one place. That's why we kind of actually need ETL. ETL lets us extract all of these random different disparate sources and loads into a single place, which could be something like a data warehouse. So this is where we kind of like, it motivates us the need to understand ETL in the first place. Before I continue, I do want to mention about data warehouse. I feel a lot of people understand it, but they're not very clear on the differences between data warehouse and other kinds of products. It took me a while as well to kind of understand the differences, and I just want to make sure I cover them here. So in any internet kind of company, there are actually usually two kinds of processing. One is transactional, which is, say, somebody comes and places an order, right? That's a transaction. That is transactional processing, right? So usually all of that is usually stored in databases like MySQL databases. Those are the most common databases. And these are built for so-called OLTP systems. And OLTP stands for online transactional processing. They allow for really fast writes, fast updates, and fast reads, but they're not meant for large analytical queries. Can you think of an analytical query which is so-called not transactional? So you might be thinking of analytical queries like count and sum if you want to know what was your total sales yesterday. You'll have to go over all your order history and then sum up each order and then kind of bring that up. So databases are good for just making a record and updating them, but they're not great at like doing these counts and sums and so on. So that's where data warehouses kind of come in. And data warehouses are used for analytical processing, or OLAP, which is online analytical processing systems. And the reason data warehouses are able to do these kind of counts and sums faster is because they usually use columnar structures. So they store the transaction amount they co-locate the transaction amount in the same place in memory. So if you're looking for the sum of transaction sum, you just go to that one specific location in memory and do the sum over them. That's where kind of the OLAP and the OLTP systems kind of come in, and that's where kind of a databases versus data warehouses comes in. So one is the OLTP, fast write, fast read, fast updates at a row level, and OLAP is more like columnar based fast analytical queries, which you can think of in terms of counts and sums and so on. So usually when the management is looking to do data driven decisions, they are actually looking for analytical processing, right? So that's why a lot of the dashboarding BI tools like Tableau or Looker or Power BI are hooked up. Just beneath them lives a data warehouse, which is a clear source of information, which is kind of curated by data engineers. It's living there in a data warehouse, and that powers the BI tools. So now you might be wondering, okay, that's good to know about database and data warehouses. How do we go from data lake to a data warehouse, right? As I mentioned earlier, data lake is like shells where everything is living disparately. So you might have email threads, you might have like really like a messy data. So you definitely need a way for you to convert different kinds of sources into, first of all, into a data lake, and then from data lake into a data warehouse, which can then power the BI tools. That's where ETL and ELT kind of comes in, all right? So when we began this episode, I gave an example of a simple ETL process where we were picking shells, so we were extracting, we were transforming by cleaning them and then loading the necklace to your friend by shipping it. In the same way, we need to do that kind of ETL process to extract the random and disparate sources, transform the data sets, so like fill in missing data, impute the data set, do different kinds of things, and then you load it into a data warehouse, which then stores, which is the canonical source of your data set in your organization. And that warehouse then powers a BI tool, a business intelligence visualization tool like Tableau or Looker or Power BI. There are pros and cons to different tools, even among the BI tools, but typically what they provide is an interface where business users can come in and get nice visualizations without writing any SQL or any code. So let's come back and kind of like get an intuition for ETL and the ELT, I think, which I mentioned, right? And it's really important to understand the difference between the two, right? ETL and ELT. They're essentially doing the extract, the transform, and the load, but it's the order that matters, right? So, and let's use a shell example again. So you sent your necklace to your friend, and she said, okay, you know what? It's an amazing necklace. Let's make 1,000 of these and we can try to sell them. So now you're like, okay, let me go back to the beach and let's find a way, like an optimal way to get these 1,000 necklaces done. You go back to the beach. Now you have two options. Either you collect all the shells right there on the beach and you start making the necklaces frantically right there. You get another friend to help you and you just kind of like just make it right there on the beach, and then maybe you might want to store them, say, in a small warehouse where you keep all the made necklaces, and then you kind of ship them together to your friend. The con here is that if the necklace has an issue, or if a shell got broken among the 1,000 or something like that, like you would have to come back to your beach and build another one from scratch. So even if one shell had a problem, you might have to kind of go back and restart fully. So this is the ETL process that I was talking about, where we just extract when we transform, and then only we kind of load into our warehouse. So what's the alternate, right? So what we could do actually is take all the shells that we think might be interesting, and we load them into some trucks, and then we bring them to a data warehouse, and then we start making the necklaces. So if there is a problem in a shell or something, we just have another replacement right there. So because you've collected quite a lot of them already. That sounds really awesome, right? Like it's much more streamlined. You have a better process where You're extracting the shells, you are loading them into trucks first, you're bringing them to a warehouse, and then you transform them afterwards. Well, the con here is that, well, you can guess it, is you need to use the trucks, right? You need all that storage to bring those giant collection of shells and then kind of bring through a warehouse, and then you need a team to parse them, clean them, and then you kind of start making the necklaces. So this is the ELT, right? Where you are loading all your raw materials into a warehouse first, and then you transform them. So in the ETL version, you do the transform right away. You extract the raw data, you transform, and then you load to a warehouse. In ELT, you extract, you load, and finally you transform. The ELT land, we will extract the raw materials, or rather the raw data. Then we'll load it into warehouse first. So we've not done any transformation. We haven't extracted any keywords. We haven't imputed. We haven't really like added any information or insights. We just load that raw data right away into a warehouse. And then we start transforming that back and load it back into the warehouse. So what we do is we extract, we load, we transform, and then we load back into the warehouse. So that's the kind of difference between ETL and ELT. So you might have one schema, which is for the raw data, where automatically, say, your website is directly loading into that warehouse, that particular schema. Then you have these SQL or Python scripts that kind of transform that and loads back into a completely different schema, say, called production. So you can use different schemas within the same data warehouse to manage the ELTL process. Yes, I did say ELTL, so it's either ETL or ELTL. But typically, people call ELTL as ELT, right? So that's where ELT versus ETL kind of comes from. So which one would we use, one over another? When would we use what? So if storage is an issue, then ETL is definitely better. However, nowadays, warehouses have become really cheap. All right, and the data warehouses, I mean, maybe the physical warehouses are still expensive, I don't know, but I mean, in terms of data warehouses, they're definitely very cheap, and storage costs are no longer a problem usually. A more valid reason to use ETL over ELT would be for sensitive data. So in case of shells, imagine if some shells are poisonous, and we don't want them anywhere near our warehouse. We would want them to be cleaned and processed at first on the beach itself, and then loaded into a truck, right, and made into a necklace. Same with sensitive data. We wouldn't want to load any personally identifiable data right into warehouse and then be transformed later, right? Like, what if your warehouse gets hacked or so on and so forth? So, you know, most of the times people do ETL for those sensitive GDPR compliant data and so on, right? So that's a very valid use case for ETL. A place where ELT is better is if you think your transformations will have frequent changes. So transformations could be anywhere from filling and imputing data to adding keywords and calculating statistics, aggregations, and so on. And if you think there will be changes to this, if you think the logic is pretty complex, it might be better to do ELT so that you can compare both the pre-transformed and post-transformed data in the same place, right? And if you need to like roll back, you can. You still have that raw kind of clean and clear data available in that loaded state. A common place where ELT is actually applied is web analytics. So you could use a tool called Like Segment, which tracks all the user actions on a website and directly loads into this raw schema in a warehouse. So you'll want to load all the customer interactions and transactions and just keep them, and then you do the roll-ups and aggregations later, and then use that for business intelligence. One tool which you know I find really great to do ELT is DBT. So DBT is a great tool which kind of like lets you do ELT really well. It lets you version control your SQL code. You can commit all your code into a Git repo, and it basically maintains all the changes to your transform code which you do in SQL. It also comes with a lot of macros and connectors, which are really great, I think. One thing I did not mention so far is what are the different kinds of warehouses and what are the options for that, right? So Redshift, Snowflake, and BigQuery. These are like really three of the very, very famous warehouses. Redshift is an AWS offering, just like S3. So a lot of people use S3 and Redshift kind of together. BigQuery is the GCP or Google Cloud Platform offering, and Snowflake is yet another option. I have compared Redshift and Snowflake extensively and have been really impressed with how fast and smooth Snowflake is. It also supports pay-as-you-use format, so you're only charged for the compute and the queries that you run. Redshift, on the other hand, charges you no matter what, as long as instances are running. So far, we have mostly talked about something that is quite manageable, right? Like 1,000 necklaces, small amount of data, and so on. What if people really love your shells and the necklaces that you're building, and they want not thousands, but rather millions and millions of them, even billions? So what you might then need is multiple processing machines, which kind of take all these different shells and work in parallel to build these necklaces, right? You'll agree with me that you might need several of these machines, which are then cranking out thousands of necklaces each day. This is much better than having just one machine do all the processing of necklaces. And this is where I feel the star of the show for building data engineering pipelines comes in. That is what a big data framework like Spark does. Spark is a key technology that lets you not worry about the scale of your data or your scale of your records, and you can just focus on writing your ETL code. And Spark kind of comes in and helps you go to that next level, go to that next scale. The word big data got popularized in early 2010s, and Hadoop got really popular. You might be wondering how Hadoop is different from Spark. Basically, Spark is a faster version of Hadoop. They both are made for big data. They both use MapReduce techniques underneath, but Spark keeps the chunks of data in memory, while Hadoop keeps the data as physical files in disk storage. That's what makes Spark much faster, because in Hadoop, you'll have to go and read that chunks of file from storage back and forth, and you know that's really slow. So that's one of the reasons why Spark is really fast, right? So everybody today, if anyone is getting into big data or large data processing, they usually prefer Spark over Hadoop. One thing is, Spark doesn't come out with its own storage solution out of the box. While Hadoop has HDFS, which is a storage system, so some people might be using HDFS with Spark and so on. But with Spark, the way you use storage is again by putting data in places like S3 and then leveraging that data set and load it into memory in different worker nodes and then managing and running computations over that in Spark. So Spark lets you do ETL or ELT at scale for billions of records. Spark can also kind of, as I mentioned, read from places like S3, read and write to data warehouses. It has all the connectors that you can expect. So it can do extract from a number of places. And Spark works very well with Python. Like there is PySpark, which is writing Spark code in Python. You can also write Spark code in other languages like R or Scala. Scala is a more of a Java-like JVM-based language. So depending on what people are comfortable in, you can actually interact with Spark in different kinds of languages. You can also interact with it using Spark SQL. So if you're more comfortable with SQL and building data engineering pipelines, you could just write SQL and then interact with Spark. Why I like PySpark is that you can actually write a lot of code in Python. So you can actually use NumPy arrays and stuff like that. And Python has a lot of great tooling for data scientists. And a lot of data scientists actually prefer to use Python. And PySpark just logically builds over Python. And if you've used Pandas before to do kind of like a small file processing, you'll really relate with the PySpark API because it does a lot of the similar things. It's a little different from Pandas in the sense of it's a little bit more verbose and it's only supports immutable operations. But PySpark feels very much like a replacement for Pandas, where you're able to do a lot of transformations for big data using the PySpark API. So coming back to ETL versus ELT, we already mentioned some of the pros and cons of each one, and you could do either of them with Spark. If you were to load all your disparate sources to a warehouse and then transform them in Spark, this would be ELT. But if you were to extract all of these different disparate sources living in your data lake, like S3, email threads, JSON, CSV, and so on, then collecting them, transforming them, and then loading to a warehouse, that would be ETL, right? And you could do the T step in Spark really well. You can also do a hybrid where one stage extracts and loads to S3, and then another stage transforms that S3 data, imputes, adds new information, so on, and then writes to warehouse. So it could do a combination of ETL and ELT. I mean, it's like really a lot of combinations are possible. Spark also has support for parallel machine learning algorithms. So you could actually do ETL, ELT, load to warehouse, power your BI apps, and be done, right, for the managers and providing data-driven decisions. But for the second group that we were initially talking about, like your ML engineers and your data scientists, Spark supports parallel machine learning algorithms using MLlib. It divides your data across machines and periodically updates your machine learning model's parameters during gradient descent. So what you're doing is that you're loading the same model in each of your worker nodes. You provide a subset of data to each of your nodes. You do your back prop, you update. So you want to like provide your weight updates. So the way you do that is you communicate between all your worker nodes and then you provide the weight updates. And this is called all reduce technique, right? So we talked about map reduce, which is kind of like a general Spark based data processing technique, but all reduce is specifically used for training ML models in a data parallel way, where you are parallelizing your data and you are then sharing weight updates periodically. MLlib doesn't have support for all ML algorithms, but it's slowly catching up. So we've covered a lot of ground. Thanks for listening so far, right? So we used the shells example. We built one necklace and we explained how ETL works there. Then we talked about 1,000 necklaces and we compared ELT versus ETL. Then we were talking about making millions of necklaces and we went into learning about Spark and how Spark has all of these worker nodes which are processing on a chunks of data set. We also talked about MLlib and doing parallel machine learning. One thing we haven't talked about yet is orchestration, right? So why would you ever need orchestration? So imagine when you are building these millions of necklaces, you'll need to make sure that each of your process is aware about the previous one, right? So you wouldn't want your machines to start kind of like running even before shells are loaded into it, right? So each of the step is kind of intra-dependent to each other, and it's kind of sequential. And in data pipeline land, we call this a DAG, or directed acyclic graph. And why it's acyclic is because a process can only go forward, like there are no loops within it. And one of the greatest kind of like upcoming tools and becoming really popular tool for managing the DAGs is Airflow. So Airflow is a tool that kind of manages the orchestration of these processes. So in for the shells, you could actually hire a person who would be so-called like a project manager who would see whether the shells are loaded correctly, what's the timing. He would call the drivers to make them send the trucks at a certain time of the day. So, you know, you could imagine a team or a person doing that for your shell business. In the same way, for a data pipeline land, like you can actually have an automated orchestrator. And what that would do is it would actually schedule all your different tasks and jobs and runs them whenever you want. So it could be daily, it could be weekly or monthly. So you could, like, the alternative to using Airflow would be using custom cron scripts where you write all your Python jobs and you run them at specific times using a cron scripts. But they're hard to manage and, you know, they're really error prone. And what Airflow does great is it provides this UI for you, where you can actually see which are the jobs that have failed, which have succeeded, how long they have taken, and so on. It's a nice, like, pretty UI with all the different colors and so on. So using Airflow and Spark to do a lot of your data engineering pipelines, I think, is becoming really popular, and they are being used along with tools like S3, Redshift, Snowflake to power BI tools. So I think that really covers a lot of ground, honestly. And I think next I actually want to talk about is more specifics on different kinds of file formats, the different technology options, and so on and so forth. So yeah, let's get started on that. One of the first things you need to think about with specific technology options is how to actually run Spark. There are various ways to host and run Spark. You could run and host it on your own using your own individual EC2 machines. You could choose to not go to cloud at all. You could run them on an on-prem kind of environment. So you have an option of kind of self-managing it by downloading open source Spark and kind of running it. But it takes a lot of expertise to run and manage that. And especially if you want to do a POC and see if Spark is right for you, I would actually definitely recommend you to try a fully managed service, which could be something like Amazon EMR, which is Elastic MapReduce service by Amazon. Or you could use something like Databricks, which is a fully managed service created by Spark creators, and it manages Spark clusters, and it is completely cloud agnostic. So if you wanted to work in Amazon environment, you could go ahead with EMR. If you want to be cloud agnostic and work with a tool which is actually custom built specifically for Spark, I think Databricks is really awesome. And both of these services provide you notebooks to work with, which are similar to Jupyter notebooks, where you can write your code, interact with the code and in the cells, and kind of visualize the code and visualize the data, I mean, and then you can run it. With EMR, you have things like Zeppelin notebooks that are used to kind of run that big data jobs. Databricks, you have these interactive notebooks which use these all-purpose clusters, which they charge quite a lot for, honestly, but they let you interact with it directly. Databricks also has something called Jobs Cluster, which lets you, it's much cheaper, like 4 to 5 times cheaper, but you would have to schedule the jobs. You are not able to use the notebooks interactively. These are the two kind of like the fully managed services that are really great to use. And the next thing that we should talk about is actually on data formats, right? So CSV and JSON are really great because they are like human readable formats, and they are really great to read and load and so on. But for really large data sets, you don't want them to become massive in terms of size, right? And in terms of that, like, you want to have lower memory footprint, you want the processing to be faster. In that sense, I think Parquet, Avro, or Delta could be some of the file formats that you could use. Parquet is a columnar storage type, while Avro is row-based format. Parquet is common with big data sets as it lets you query specific columns quickly. Another option is to use Delta format, which is on top of Parquet, but adds history of events, transaction logs, and other features. So Delta lets you kind of like, it's built on top of Parquet, which is, Parquet is a columnar kind of data format, and Delta kind of brings in this history of events and transaction logs. So Delta is actually a pretty cool format, and you could use any of these formats in S3, like what we were discussing earlier. We briefly talked about some of the choices of data warehouses, which would be something like Amazon Redshift by AWS, or BigQuery by Google Cloud Platform, or Snowflake. Snowflake is a really fast and an amazing option in terms of data warehouses. Yet another option for you is to use something like Lakehouse architecture, which kind of combines the data lake and warehouses into one place. And Delta Lake is one such offering, and it's kind of an offering from Databricks. So Databricks has been expanding a lot. They're growing like crazy, honestly, guys. And Databricks obviously provides these notebooks and a way for you to host a Spark cluster, but they have also started to do these other services like Delta Lake, where they kind of host that Delta format files and provide you with an interface to write SQL queries and visualize that. Delta Lake is kind of like an offering which replaces some of the warehouses like Snowflake or Redshift. So that kind of, so we talked about file formats and some of the data warehouses. You might also want to consider about how would you do the monitoring. So Airflow would let you orchestrate and see which stages have failed, which tasks have failed. You might also want to use Spark UI, it's called Ganglia UI, to see metrics of different workers like CPU usage, free memory, network bandwidth, etc. You can hook some of the Spark jobs to Datadog as well to kind of monitor these. So guys, thanks for coming and joining me so far on this journey on understanding data engineering pipelines. And let us summarize what we have learned so far. I think I can summarize them with three key ideas. One is ETL versus ELT, which is basically about how you process and extract raw data and transform that data into something which can be used for data-driven decision-making or machine learning. ETL does the transformation before loading into a data warehouse, while ELT loads first and then transforms and then loads back again. That's point one. Point two is that there are services like Spark, which lets you run same ETL, ELT stuff at scale. All right. And that scale lets you do things like processing millions and millions of records in a few hours or a few minutes. You can also do things like streaming data where you are able to process it in a few milliseconds or seconds. Right. That's all available in Spark or Spark Streaming. Spark also supports machine learning with MLlib, right? So that's part two. Part one is ETL versus ELT. You can use Python, you can use Pandas, you can use SQL for that. Part two is Spark, which is using large data. And the third is orchestration and monitoring, which you can use Airflow and some of the other monitoring. With Amazon, you can do CloudWatch. With Spark, you can use Ganglia UI. These kind of three core concepts are used in a lot of large data engineering pipelines at scale. And how we learned about these three things was using a shell and necklace business on a beach, where we understood how to do ETL versus ELT, how would we extract the shells from a beach and load them into trucks and then into our warehouse to make necklaces. We understood how to parallelize that operation using many, many different machines at the same time, which is Spark. And then we understood about how we would hire a project manager to orchestrate everything. And then we learned about Airflow, right? So yeah, it was a lot of fun crafting this example. I hope you enjoyed hearing about that and hope that made the journey a little bit easier. So what a knowledge of data engineering pipelines gets you is that you now know how to extract and drill the data and put it into pristine data sets. Now you can use MLlib or SageMaker or some other machine learning framework, TensorFlow, Kubeflow, and so on. Like, you can use all these tooling which is around machine learning to really utilize these data sets and make a difference in your organization and for your customers. You can build that model, which can then be used with, say, a Lambda function, which is then connected to the world via a REST endpoint and API gateway. That API gateway can then basically connect your users via a website all the way down to Lambda, which then calls SageMaker, which then calls your pristine data sets sitting in either Redshift or Snowflake, or it could call the model which is being hosted in SageMaker, right? So I know I said a bunch of words there, but I think as you continue the journey, I think they will become easier. I hope this podcast was helpful in some way, and looking forward to your feedback. If you have any, please reach out to me on LinkedIn. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast and also share it if you enjoyed this. Thanks for listening, guys, and have a great rest of the week.